sensitive. They can feel self and you. They're not afraid to feel. Just to go with my example, there's seven of them, but present, for example, they have disciplined their mind out of the rat brain, you know, digital addiction. Like they could actually meditate you into the present moment with how available they are with 100% of their being. And when you have two people doing this together, you can have an orgasm without even touching. I'm sure you already know this. I can tell from your practice.
You're listening to the Femme Codes podcast, a sacred space for your erotic embodiment and sensual empowerment. Here I share the codes for leading radical women into their highest expressions of self, into leading turned on orgasmic lives. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Femme Codes podcast. This episode is a journey into sacred intimacy, into relational dynamics, and basically a conversation on how to really create deep polarity and union within your partnership and within all relationships. In this episode, I'm joined with London Angel Winters, and she is an author, teacher, and thought leader in the conversation of sacred intimacy. Her passion is helping others reclaim pleasure, thrive in sacred relationship, and love like they have never been hurt. Wouldn't that be amazing, by the way, if each one of us came to relationship and a relational moment like we had never been hurt before? That is absolute trust, that is absolute surrender. It is a complete freedom in the way we love. And that's why I really love these teachings, because it really teaches us to and reflects how we can live more in alignment to love's truth in a way that is in the present moment. And that's the beauty of a lot of meditation, right? It's all in the moment. It is all here right now is where the deepest medicine and liberation really lies for us. It is where we can see ourselves clearly and where we can see another clearly. It is where we are no longer distracted by the outside world and our old ways of being, and instead we are just right here, right now with our beloved or with the person that we're relating with, deep in the moment, deeply connected and deeply present. That is some soul fucking food right there. So London and her partner, Justin Patrick Pierce, are the authors of Playing with Fire, The Spiritual Path of Intimate Relationship and The Awakened Woman's Guide to Everlasting Love. The owner's manuals for attracting love and creating passion and sustaining sacred relationship. Together, they lead transformative high-end retreats that immerse attendees in their signature training, which is Yoga of Intimacy. London offers private intimacy coaching for singles and couples, weekend workshops, monthly group calls, as well as online video courses, and so much more. She is an absolute powerhouse in this work, and her transmission is so deeply valued in my world, and I really hope that it brings deep value for all of you that listen to this episode. So let's jump in.
Welcome to the Femme Codes podcast. I think this is going to be a really juicy and beautiful conversation. And one thing I'd love to start us off with is, what is something that makes you feel like your most liberated self?
Expressing the truth of my heart without worrying about losing love, without seeking to gain love, and allowing the other person's experience, however they receive me, meaning like if it's a lot for them, immediately having compassion for that. I really feel liberated in that because I feel this aspect of being fully realized in my flow and kind and compassionate, you know? Mm-hmm. Not like laying my trip as it, but like actually loving as it. That's when I really truly feel the most liberated. That's also when I'm the most sexually liberated as well. It's a great first question.
Yeah, I really started opening up the episodes with that question because it just feels right. It feels on purpose. It feels in the moment. And it's something that really awakens us to, even if it's, we're not in the experience of liberation in the moment, it awakens our awareness there. Love that. Your version of liberation. So this podcast is kind of going to be aimed into all things around sacred intimacy, devotional union, and all the beautiful things that you teach, as well as your partner. And I'd love to first open it up with something that I heard. It may have been a very old podcast way back when, but it was around with the temple snakes. And when I was listening to it, it really caught my attention, caught my consciousness, my heart even. And you were speaking into working with snakes as a medicine for women. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, kind of how your journey has been with that and what medicine snakes brought to you, and to just share with the listeners, what exactly is it like working with snakes as a medicine and in ritual and ceremony, even if it's something that you may not be currently doing?
Mm-hmm. My first experience with snakes was a deep awakening of a memory when I was really young, like 4 years old. We lived in deep woods, and I would spend the whole day in the woods, and I would play with snakes. I was really not afraid, and it was just something I would do, and I had completely forgotten about all of that. And then I was doing temple work in LA. I was living in LA at the time, and one of my favorite teachers, who did a lot of womb dancing, randomly one weekend, you know, I would womb dance all the time, but randomly one weekend she offered a snake workshop, and I signed up. Honestly, I had no recollection of this experience as a child. I just walked in that room, cause I loved her. And I was like, whatever she's doing is cool. I'll give it a try. The minute she put a serpent on me, I was transported into this absolute, deeply shamanic journey. Like my feet went out from under me kind of experience, where I wasn't cognitively creating the moment. The moment was doing me. I had my eyes closed, and the serpent had messages and imprints, and It was the closest thing to lovemaking that I've ever experienced outside of lovemaking. And then after that, all of the memories woke up of my experience as a child. And I literally had an obsession with, like, you know, kind of like the way you would with a lover. Like if you had an amazing experience with a lover and you woke up the next morning and you could taste it in your mouth, and like, all you wanted to do was like reconnect with this experience, right? So I ended up getting a snake. I adopted a snake who had been given up because she was very fierce, kind of like, you know, the wild Mustang of snakes. And for some reason, again, for things that my cognitive mind doesn't understand, I picked her to start, you know? And I would have to stand at her tank for 20 minutes to like get my hand in there to approach her. She was so not like go along, get along, but I could earn her trust. And if I just moved at the speed of awakening, I could earn her trust. And then when she would, you know, give me herself, and she would move on me. It was like crossing the veil. It really was. And so she became mine, and I started offering ceremony. I ended up having four snakes later, but for the sake of this podcast, I'll just keep it with Vincent, you know, my great love. She taught me so much that has created my, what I call Omega practice, divine feminine practice. One quick example of what she did for me, she did so many things. And for every single person she ever worked with, she did something different. It wasn't like she gave the same medicine. It would be a completely different experience, and it would be like the thing they needed to unlock their body. And like one example of one thing she did for me was, at that time, my understanding of polarity work was very traditional. Like, if you want polarity, you move a lot for him. You know, you sound a lot for him. I'd kind of like taken the Kool-Aid. And so I'd like gotten myself into like big movements and lots of responsiveness was like my main goal in life, you know? And man, did the snake call bullshit on me. She called so much bullshit on me. And so like when I would start, you know, I was like, oh, I'm having this like snake experience. I'm going to let this ripple across my body. You know, she would crawl off of me. Right.
Right.
She got me to the point where I couldn't even have a thought that I knew where it was going. I had to be so in the moment, completely surrendered to the sensation and only respond in full surrender to the exact thing with no choreography, no looking good, no dancing. You know, the irony is it's called sacred snake dancing, but there's no dancing involved. There's just full surrender into listening. Mm. And if I didn't, she would like squeeze me, or she would crawl off of me, or she would, you know, and if I did, she would send like orgasmic connection, visions. It was so profound. And what it allowed me to do was really wake up to the fact that I'm more like sap in a tree in my feminine. I'm deep and slow, and I'm thick, and I dilate into the pleasure. And like to be that present and that subtle, I can't be dancing as a show. I can't be like putting on a performance for you. And it was this huge leap because I felt like such a failure as like a practitioner compared to what everyone was being coached to do. But Vincent really just had me trust myself. And I can honestly tell you that everything in my pleasure body awakened when I finally made the leap into being real and like honoring my own speed and into like being responsive the way my body responsive, not like what it's supposed to look like. Mm. That is just one lesson I got from Vincent.
Just one lesson from the snakes.
Yeah. Just one of like lifetimes of lessons. So it was special. Mm. And then what happened was, I found myself pregnant at 47, like, you know, when I got my four temple snakes, I really didn't think I was going to ever have children. Like I was so far beyond that age. And I actually found myself pregnant, like surprise, you know, which was a beautiful gift. But I had set up this life. Like my husband and I didn't have any furniture because we were just practice, you know. We had four like 6 foot snakes, you know what I mean? Like we just didn't have, we had like life of like sexual yogis, you know, and I ended up having to give them to my main dancer because, you know, it just didn't match like having like a rambunctious 2-year-old banging on their tanks and them looking at her like, is it dinner time? You know, it's not good. So they now do ceremony through someone else. I just say that so that I don't get a bunch of emails like, I want a ceremony.
Yeah. Not ideal for having tiny humans around really large pythons that are hungry a lot of the time.
Exactly. Definitely not ideal. They could wrap her around like 6 times before they were done, right?
Yeah, beautiful. Well, it sounds like the snakes really brought their own medicine. And I feel like they just have this deep inner world and inner knowing and sight and way of feeling that I feel sometimes we are very much avoidant, closed, insensitive to. And I really feel like they can be beautiful teachers. And anyone I feel like that works with shamanism and animals, I think would say the same. I think they're really great portals into a world that we can't quite grasp, but have a deep knowing inside of ourselves has value and has a connection to spirit. So that's really beautiful.
I couldn't agree with you. Have you moved with a snake before?
I haven't moved with a snake. I've held snakes, but I have not danced with a snake. I would love to dance with a snake. I have a dear sister who also has a python, and she works with that python quite a lot. But temple dancing with a snake, not yet. To come.
Cool. Well, you really get it, because there's something, there's an ancient wisdom they give you, and it's vibratory. It's a vibrational thing. It literally wakes up a knowledge in your body. It's a true initiation, even if you only do it once.
Yeah. And I really feel like it was an ancient feminine art as well in the temples. Like, I feel like this is something that we have been doing for years and years and years as women, but is forgotten. So all it is remembering the ancient wisdom that already exists within us and is just coming forward again.
Precisely. Precisely. Yeah. And the other thing about snakes, I'll say, is that they stay with you. The medicine stays with you, and they'll be a guide for you. I still can work with my snakes, even though I'm not I don't do the husbandry. They're forever my guides. So it's like a beautiful partnership.
Yeah, beautiful. Like, you can work with them inside the spirit realm and keep them with you as a guide, just like you would any other angel or ally. I really love that. And you also mentioned it really impacted your omega feminine practice. So for our listeners that might not know, and this is one reason why I really love your work and also Justin's work, is that you are a couple that have been in the polarity space for, I think it was 12 years. Is that correct?
Like, yeah, a little more than that now. Yep.
Beautiful. So you've had this ongoing relationship that seems to be really thriving, and you've also taken the polarity that has been really, I guess, dogmatic in a way, and you've brought it into your own way of teaching. And it feels more true, I think, in essence, in some ways. And I feel like it can really benefit people. So just for people that don't understand, and maybe they've only heard like masculine and feminine terms, what is alpha and omega to you and in your teachings that you share?
Well, for many years, we really taught the alpha and the omega, which, by the way, that language wasn't like, oh, let's brand it ourselves. That language came because we were trying to do traditional polarity. And what we were noticing is that we were full spectrum human beings. Like, we're artists that can play the whole piano. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? And I didn't want to just play the right, and he didn't want to just play the left, you know? And so we really wanted to play every note. But every time I would say, you know, something about his feminine, it just, because of the language and all of the, like, you know, bija mantras, like all of the intention that's gone into that language, he could never really feel good about being in his feminine. You know, it always sounded like an insult, and I can never really feel like beautiful being in my masculine. And we realized, like, this language is so limiting. So then we really sat and we meditated on what's new language that doesn't have the limitations. Alpha and omega came through. Ironically, we sat in a meditation, not talking, obviously. We both got it. That's when we knew it was it. Like, we both came out of the meditation. Yeah, it was so cool. Wow. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was so cool. And it's liberated us. Talk about liberating, because, like, I can do a very sexy alpha and Justin can do a very seductive omega, you know? I mean, in the end, so for many years, we came up with this language many, many years ago, and we taught it as, like, Yeah, alpha is that divine masculine, omega is that divine feminine. But we just released our new book, Playing with Fire. And every time we write a book, we get new stuff. Like the guides start talking and all sorts of new material comes through. And they really showed us that it goes even beyond that. Alpha is the seer. I see. And omega is the feeler. I feel. And when you put I see and I feel together, sparks, right? Like imagine sitting in front of a partner and they said, I see your heart is heavy. And then the other partner says, I feel seen. And then the alpha says, I see you love a lot and it's hard for you sometimes. Mm. And then omega says, I feel loved. You know, you can just see the polarity that exists when somebody is holding consciousness, the seer, the witness, the observer, and somebody's holding the feeler, which is that immersing into life and this moment and snakes, you know, like everything that is the gift of being incarnated. And when you put the two of those together and you make love in two bodies, you get one body. But then what's so beautiful about understanding Alpha and Omega is seer and feeler is it becomes very obvious that after the lovemaking moment and the polarity of two bodies coming to one, you go into your day. Are you really any less of a seer because you're in a relationship? Mm. Right? Are you any less of a feeler because you could hold space for a relationship? No. And so now we've liberated it even more where you realize that when you're on your own during the day in your, what we would call one body practice, you're in deep lovemaking between your own seer and feeler. Mm-hmm. So you have a tough, right? You have a tough moment and your seer says, oh, I see that hurt your heart. And the feeler says, oh, I'm hurting. And the seer says, I see you, right? You could be doing this with yourself. And then all you do to create clarity with your intimate partner is when you're back in the lovemaking moment, you just take one of the sides and the other person takes the other. And you give them the luxury of being your other half so that the two bodies tremble to come together as one. But then that internal lovemaking kicks right in when that moment's done and you're just doing that supercharged polarity dance with yourself all day. And then you get this in healing and hot. In other words, this can be healing in a relationship when you understand seer and feeler. And it's not always appropriate to be rough, like sexually rough and sexually tussly. Sometimes you just need to have a gentle moment with each other and you could still be polarized when you understand one person's the seer and the other's the feeler. It's as simple as it is.
Beautiful. Yeah, I really love that you shared around how it becomes our own practice throughout the day. And I think that's a really important piece for people to realize is that you're not just practicing making love to the divine in your relationship. You're literally making love in all moments and making love to yourself through those polarities. And it's a potent practice because it not only, I feel, in my own reflections, makes you more deeply connected to your truth and your heart and your sovereignty and how to hold yourself deeper so that when you come to a partnership or in any intimate relationship, you're coming from a more fuller space or a more grounded space or a space that's more connected to yourself and to the other because you're choosing to honor yourself throughout the day and build that practice without them even being in front of you. And I really feel like that's true devotion. Like that itself is true devotion. And you mentioned the book. So I was also reading this throughout the week. Amazing book, by the way. Whoever's listening to this, if you really want to drop into these teachings and read London's book, amazing book. And you mentioned in there the traits of a masterful lover and a terrible lover. So what are some of the traits of the terrible lover that you guys have spoken about and you've spoken about? And what are some of the traits of the masterful lover? I'd love to go into both of them.
Yeah, we have this whole chapter on the terrible lover and that most people really are born and programmed to think that, you know, it's something genetic, like how tall you are, how big your penis is, or how tiny your waist is compared to your ass. You know, I mean, we get all these ideas of what makes us a good lover, and they're fixed things. Or if, you know, we could spend our whole lives trying to whatever, lose weight and just waste all that energy. But when you really look at what creates a masterful lover, and you realize a whole new idea of what creates a terrible lover. A terrible lover is someone, for example, who is unaware. Case in point, they walk in to the house and they say, "Oh, you wore that today? That looks terrible on you." And then they walk into the kitchen. They don't even notice what their words, the impact their words had on you. The impact you're sitting in, they don't see it, right? It's a bad seer. They don't see what they do to you. And they kind of just like create damage as they go. Maybe they reach in too fast, kill the moment. Your body's like, you know, pulling back, and they don't modulate because they can't even see that they're turning you off. Like, this is what really makes a terrible lover. Another example is somebody who's insensitive. You could be very feeling, you could be a wildly feeling person, but not be sensitive, because all you can feel is you. You can't feel the impact you have on them. You know, maybe you're in a mood, in a snit, and you're all into your mood and you're killing the people around you, but you don't even notice because you can't feel them. You can't feel beyond self. In contrast, a masterful lover, male or female, alpha or omega, so highly sensitive, right? They can feel their lover's heart as their own. They can feel their lover's orgasm in their own body. They're not afraid to take a big, deeply feeling breath because they're unafraid to feel. If we're afraid to feel, we don't breathe. If you don't breathe, you don't saturate your sexual sponge, right? You're so dry. Mm-hmm. These are just two examples, right? We could look at someone who can't be in the present moment anymore, right? How terrible is it to be with a lover who's like on a date with you and they can't even listen to the answer to the question they asked you? They're like scanning the restaurant. Or to be with a lover in bed and you can feel that 50% of them is in the meeting that's coming up later, or how they're going to make their quick exit. You know what I mean? They're not with you. Masterful lover, someone who's aware, they can see so clearly self and you. Sensitive, they can feel self and you. They're not afraid to feel. Just to go with my example, there's seven of them, but present, for example, they have disciplined their mind out of the rat brain, you know, digital addiction. Like, they could actually meditate you into the present moment with how available they are with 100% of their being. And when you have two people doing this together, you can have an orgasm without even touching. I'm sure you already know this. I can tell from your practice. Presence, like, you lack presence, you're going to be a terrible lover. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. You have presence. I don't care if you have all the attributes that society has said is unattractive. You could absolutely rock another person's world and show them the face of the divine. And so one of the things Justin and I do in this book is we really challenge like people's notions of what a terrible lover is. And we point to some of the really deeper stuff that causes lovemaking to be so sour, that causes intimacy to be so shitty. And then we look at how do you become masterful? We call it being a fire keeper, where you always have that beautiful sexual pilot light burning and you make art out of it in your day with yourself and with your lover, your chosen lover. That's what being a fire keeper is. It's like cultivating the seven skills that make you masterful and then using them like artwork all day long.
Like an artist.
Like an artist. Precisely.
Yeah. So for your example, right, you're in this thriving relationship. You also have as a one tiny human, and you have a thriving relationship as well as running a business with your beloved. And I feel like that's quite a rare occurrence. Do you feel like everyone can cultivate this? Do you feel like everyone can, you know, live their life, have a deep intimacy and still have, you know, all the things happening in the world that they've got?
For sure. Mostly because prior to becoming a sexual yogini, I didn't, right? Like, I know what it's like. I wasn't like born into an ashram and given this stuff at like an early age. And like, I've just been living this my whole life. Like, I found this work in my late 30s after a just miserable experience in love and sex. And when I learned the art of surrender, everything changed, right? Everything changed. That was what really unlocked this whole world for me, was learning how to surrender. Because then I woke up to the deep feminine principle, right? I woke up to the mystery school and I began including the mystery school in my intimacy experiences. Like, I wasn't pretending to be less deep than I really am. I wasn't pretending to be less emotional than I really am. I wasn't, you know, trying to be popular. I was looking for depth and I was looking for that real experience of meeting the moment with another. And then I found Justin and we did a good 10 years. I think it was 10 years. I get spongy on time, so don't quote me on the time, but we did a really, really long time of it just being us. And we really truly live and breathe these teachings. So our whole relationship has been based in it. And as a result, I'll just give you a quick, we call it practices. This sounds like a total diminishment of such beautiful sacred practices, but we call them the pool filter. We do them every day and they clean our pool, the pool of our relationship, like a pool filter. If you turn off the filter, what happens to your pool? It's green. It's got a tree in it. It's like over time, like there's no way you would want to go swim in that water, right? Life destroys the pool. But with these practices for the whole time, like for over a decade, Justin and I've been doing these practices together and the water just gets cleaned every day. And so as a result, our relationship feels like something we both are excited to dive into. And then we had been really thriving and loving this whole life where it was just kind of like deep fuck, you know? And I ended up getting pregnant and having Ava. And she is a fully loaded femme. And I'm not doing anything to squash that. I'm like, I take the hard road as a mom to keep her expression her expressions allowed. Her emotions are allowed. Her flow is allowed. And she should honor structure. Like, I'm constantly teaching her that balance between alpha and omega. And I'm really, truly dedicated to not making her expression inconvenient for us. And like, all you have to do with a three-year-old is just kind of look away when they're difficult and they'll never do it again because they love you so much. And so I'm dedicated to giving her the idea that her fullness has a place. However, that makes it so hard on our relationship, Justin and I, because she's, you know, expressing constantly, you know, and then we're trying to teach her, how do you consider mommy and daddy also with your expression? It's like, all this stuff is right here. But because Justin and I have these practices, we wrote the book because of this, we have never been stronger. I really mean it. Like, normally, I mean, if I didn't have these practices, our relationship would just be in the gutter because of having a, you know, wild rumpus of a child. But instead, it's what we use to get all of our equanimity back. Like, we go into our adult time practice, we just play it all through. I really mean, we play it all the way through. And then we walk out and we have all the room in the world for her to take center stage, you know, not overly, obviously we're not like creating, you know, a dictator of a child, but we're allowing her effulgence to be here. Hmm. And I could really see in every decision I make as a parent, like, this is where all my clients come from, right? It's so easy to kill a child's spirit.
Beautiful. Yeah, it really.
I hope I answered your question.
Yeah. I think it's so important. You know, we have been taught so often as children coming into the world out of the womb to like numb or suppress or close down or be quiet or, you know, be good. And there's layers and layers and layers and layers of conditioning. And some of them, you know, I would arguably say we need to live a human life. And some of them are quite unhelpful to our liberation and full expression. And it sounds like what you're describing is like she's very in like the omega quite a lot because she is in that feeling body quite a lot. So to hear that your teachings are also being infused into the way that you parent is really beautiful, because that all the more creates that devotion to the work and that balance and that harmony. And,
you know, I always say to her, I have this practice I do where I never stop the tears. Like if she is genuinely feeling an emotion, I literally don't interrupt it. I just hold space and I like rub her back and I'm like, show me every last tear, show me every last tear. And then as soon as she's fully complete, she'll be like, I'm done, mama. And I'll go, you're a good feeler. And she's like, I'm a good feeler. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is like what I wish someone had done for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Plus, because it's literally showing us at a young age of like how safe it is to express those emotions and what are most relationship, not most issues, but what
yes.
are relational issues related to. It's not being able to express our hearts and how we feel. So we're habitually closed in the body from my perspective, and therefore that's what we've been taught. So yep. That's going to be one clear emotional body in your future, child.
Yeah. We pay the price. You know, it's like amazing. You can just see where it all comes from because they're so impressionable. You could shut it down so fast and then they would just pull themselves together, start swallowing their no.
Yeah. It doesn't take much at all.
Nope.
The practice of rewiring that, rewinding that karma, I guess. And for that, do you believe, so I feel like the feminine or the omega can be oracular, right? It can be like an oracle for our lovers. How do you see that in your work?
I couldn't agree with you more.
Because in a
sense, yeah, go ahead.
I just had a thought come through as well. In a sense, your like your tiny human, right, would be waking you up in every moment. Does that
precisely? That is so resonant because, you know, just start there. The first thing I had to reckon with when she was born and I was dedicated to encouraging her expression is receiving it. And like being awakened by it. And it was really gave me a lot of appreciation of what Justin had been doing for me all of those years. Because there's that element where she's waking me up when I don't feel like being awakened. Or, you know, when you're being unconscious, we don't know that we're being unconscious. We only find out we're being unconscious when someone points it out. And she's doing this for me all the time. And what I've noticed as the alpha in the dynamic, she's omega and I'm alpha, is like how inconvenient that is. And it's a choice that Justin's been making for me and I'm making for her and I make for Justin when he's in his omega, that conscious love rules, not convenience. Passion rules, not productivity, right? Like there's that idea of like, just get it together because I need to, you know, I need to blah, 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 blah. Well, do you really? Like, and so going back to your original question, do you trust your heart? Do you trust the wisdom of your heart and the way it communicates? That's the question that comes at hand is, does your cognitive mind have to understand every feeling before you feel it? Or are you willing to get out of the way and let that which is beyond your understanding, animate your body. And what most people don't realize is that's actually the same thing you do when you have a full body orgasm. Mm. Full body orgasms are terribly confronting because they cause the complete annihilation of self, just like rage does, you know, fully felt rage, just like fully felt sadness and grief do. And so in the end, I think the Omega practice is a decision. Do I trust my heart and yoni? And if I do, am I willing to get out of the way and be guided and be shown? Kind of like I was saying when I was dancing with Vincent, I had to keep getting out. This is another lesson I learned from Vincent. It's like, when you don't know where it's going, you put on that child's like mind, it will show you things that you couldn't have come up with on your own. And usually what it shows you is millions of times cooler than whatever you came up with as a plan. And that's what I found day after day, experience after experience, is that the more I can drop in and trust my heart and my yoni, the more magical my life becomes. And then having the courage to let that be seen. Because for me, the first journey was to just trust it myself. The second journey was showing it and being willing to feel the unlove, meaning like, show this and it's not received exactly as I want. Am I still going to show?
Mm.
And then the third step of the journey was actually earning his trust, where now he values it like I do, because I stood by it, because I didn't like shrink. I gave him time to learn to be with it in the same way I'm learning how to be with Ava's, right? Because I get better and better at being with her truth every day, because she doesn't shrink. She gives me the opportunity to keep improving. But if like I didn't handle it right one day and then she never showed it to me again, I would never learn how to find my way with it. And then you know what? The same thing's happening in the sacred inner marriage too.
And that inner marriage being our own inner alpha and our own inner omega coming into that union together.
Yeah.
So what I'm also hearing from what you've just reflected is that it's really about bridging that connection to, one, our heart's truth, our body's truth, our pussy, our sexuality, and letting that be the transmission and then finding trust within that. What does it really take for a woman to trust herself? Mm. What does it really take within us? Because I often, at the start of my journey, before even starting the journey, it was really difficult to trust myself in like relating and what I was thinking and what I was feeling when I would get triggered. It's almost like I had no connection to the trigger and it would just run on autopilot in my body. It would be this like habitual pattern that would tell me to close. And I would then have a judgment around it, or I'd be like, this is bad. You're not meant to be feeling this. This means you're too emotional. This is going to push him away. There were all these like stories that came with the feelings rising in my body. And until I started doing a lot of clearing work and somatic work, sexuality work, those stories didn't get cleared. But specifically at the start of my journey, it was really difficult to trust it. So for those of us who struggle to trust that inner oracle, what would you say for a woman if she's wanting to build that? What are some recommendations or your reflections on that?
So in your example, you really brought up the, what I would call two body practice. Like, how does my fullness affect another? Right. So I'm going to answer from that point of view, but if you later want to talk about solo, cause there's a lot there for the solo one body practice too. Mm-hmm. But since you brought up the partner, I think it's a really great question. And there's toxic elements to this idea of how is my fullness, you know, going to land? And then there's healthy aspects. The toxic would be, am I going to lose love? Or more accurately, am I going to lose control?
Mm.
That's where the surrender piece comes in. So full animated responsiveness, you are really letting go of controlling the moment. You're not just letting go of controlling yourself, but you show someone that much of yourself and your truth, and they're going to orient around their own truth. And then you may not want to deal with that, right? Whereas if you're very censored and you're very, you're kind of like, what one of my clients said, you know, she's like, when I think about what I do, it's like, I show my husband my upset, but I put it on a dustpan. I ask for an appointment and I say, honey, how about that? You know, like when you've put that much effort into controlling his reaction, you're controlling his reaction, you know? And there's that element of not being willing to surrender to the truth of the moment, yours or his. That's the more toxic side. It's that part of us that never wants to lose love.
Mm-hmm.
Always wants to win love. You know, it's more that fantasy piece that we need to surrender beyond. Mm. But there's a healthy side, which, you know, usually when a woman comes into her fullness, she comes out swinging, you know, because she's had a lid on that for so long. It's like a volcano erupting. And that's a really normal process. And if any of your listeners are in that, I say, good. It takes that much force just to get over freezing and silencing and suppressing. Like, it takes a lot of force. And sometimes it's ugly. You know what I mean? It can really like burn some eyebrows off some other people. But ultimately, as Omega matures in her spiritual maturity and her cultivates her fullness and her, she's unafraid to feel, she loses that need to like throw the feeling into someone else's lap. She can circulate the feeling. It can be massive, uncomfortable, crazy, hard to understand feelings. And she's like a musician able to write a song about it, right? She's just like breathing that all the way into her pussy. It comes up her spine, purifies all the way into the pussy, you know, purifies, comes up her spine. And she's just literally like circulating this to herself with no need to get rid of it. No need to throw it off. No need to fix the situation, correct the, you know, no need to like start throwing daggers because somebody caused it. She becomes so good at feeling, like I say to Ava, that she's comfortable with feeling wild stuff. Again, rage and full body orgasm are almost equally uncomfortable in a certain respect, right? Mm-hmm. She gets very good at feeling. And then what she can do, she feels not only her own heart in that moment, but her partner. And that's the healthy side of this, which is like, how could I give this awakening as a gift that he could really hear, that he could truly awaken to? A perfect example, just to take it into like super concrete practical, is like in any relationship, even if it's only been 3 months, usually there's like a pattern of hurts, right? Like you kind of get the ouch in the same way, you know, like in the first week, you did a little bit of this thing. And the second week he did a lot more. And the second month he really, you know, and you just feel like the same ouch. That's always true of intimate relationship. Like where the partner's unconscious, they're kind of hurting us in the same way over and over again. So a newer practitioner finally has enough, like, right? She's been like swallowing it. And then she just can't, and the lid comes off the volcano. But in that moment, she processes not only that moment and the hurt of that moment, but blah, 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 the whole Rolodex. So if they've been together for 3 months, it's that moment and 3 months of that moment. And if they've been together for 20 years, I mean, it's an unimaginable amount of like rage because it's 20 years plus that moment. Very difficult for him to wake up to anything outside the present moment. In fact, awakening is the present moment. So if you're bringing anything that's not in the present moment, he doesn't have the opportunity to wake up. He just can defend, run away or defend. So a really advanced spiritual practitioner who's a good feeler, who can just feel all of it. Because even if you're a good practitioner, you can still swallow stuff. You're only ready when you're ready. And it's ever, it's like an onion, you know, ever deepening onion of expression. So it's not uncommon for a very advanced, seasoned practitioner to feel a hurt that they've been ignoring for 20 years in that moment. But because they're such a good feeler and they're not dissipating, they can feel and transmit the right now hurt in a way that pierces into his heart, awakens his mind, and just, it's oracular. It's so powerfully true, powerfully present, powerfully compassionate, even if it's like difficult. It's oracular. It's the kind of thing that people travel to Delphi to hear because it's like a lightning bolt of the divine. But that's when it's completely present. It's only here. It's right now. And that's what a really powerful oracle becomes very good at doing, is being fully animated, fully surrendered, and fully allowing, then orienting both hearts in the equation and giving the gift. Now, you might think that that means not pissing him off, but that's not right understanding, because you would be seeking love, seeking not to lose love, seeking to gain love. When you're unafraid to lose or gain love, and you are love, you might piss him off. It might not be fun for him to hear, but it awakens him. He can see it. It's a gift. And that's one of the best things. If you want to become an oracle, you have to stop seeking to win and stop. You have to stop seeking to win love and stop trying to not lose love. You'll never be an oracle if you still need approval. You have to know that you are love, and then animate, get out of the way and animate as love. Right?
Yeah, that really just landed. I feel like, yeah, oracle is truth. And what you're saying, from what I'm hearing as well, is, you know, you're bringing divine feeling and expressing that without the past, without history. So you're in the moment and you're fully present with that. As a woman, I think that is a deep practice, because there is often that fear, you know, of setting off our partner's inner emotions and then triggering them and bringing that hurt. And I think that's also a common dynamic. I've too experienced it in the past, where, you know, I've bought, you know, how I'm feeling, and then that's triggered the other person's stuff. And then it's like, oh my God, now all their shit's coming up as well as mine. And you're kind of in this like mess of emotion, is what I like to call it. It's like a bit of a puddle of emotion, and it's not really going anywhere. You're both feeling the stuff. You're kind of a bit closed. You're a little bit like scared to come back into the realm of like relating again. You're like, do I go too close? Am I like too far away? Am I going to like step on his toes, or are they going to step on mine? So it's a bit of this mess. If someone's in that dynamic and they are maybe constantly having that, or they're afraid of even going into that again, so they hold off their emotions, what would you say the practice is? Because is it right to say that one should be in the alpha and one should be in the omega, and that's how the balance happens to create that intimacy and that point of connection? Or what do you do when you're in an emotional mess together? You're in an emotional puddle.
Well, I would never say one should be an alpha and omega, because that's where you get into bad tennis partners. Well, you missed the serve. No, you missed the serve, right? And like all of this should that abolishes good art. You know, like if somebody said, you should move this way when you dance, are you going to really want to dance 10 minutes later?
Nah.
Not even a little, right? And that's how people feel about polarity over time. It's like, ugh, screw that. Both sides do. But what I will say is when you understand polarity and you're like, oh, okay, we're both feeling, we're both feeler. No wonder why it feels neutral or bad, because it's not polarized. It's not that yummy, romancy vibe. We're both in the feeler. So we've depolarized the moment. Now that's okay. That's okay. Maybe it's healthy for you to both kind of like get a bunch of stuff out, feeler to feeler. And you just don't expect hot sex to be present then. You're cleaning the pool. You know what I mean? Or you want to advance the spiritual practice and you want to see if you could work out big triggers from the gift of polarity. Now you're choosing into polarity, not because it's a should, but because it's a paradigm that delivers a beautiful result, which is coming together in difference, like harnessing difference as a gift. So for example, Justin and I do this all the time. I'm not kidding. Just because we're deep in this work doesn't mean we don't have run-ins. We don't end up in emotional messes. We're so honest. We're so real, raw, and honest with each other. We're not putting up facades, you know, that of course we're ending up in those places. That's the whole reason why we don't have holdbacks from each other sexually. So we end up in that, but we've treated it as a spiritual practice. So either one of us, whoever has the like wherewithal to be like, okay, feeler on feeler is not serving anyone right now. I'm going to go into the seer. It might be me. And so he's like feeling really shitty. And I go, I see your heart is heavy. I'm going to transcend myself as alpha because I'm going to help us out of it, right? I got the spiritual bandwidth. I'm going to go into alpha rather than like fight him for the role of the feeler. Hey, I see your heart is heavy. I see I hurt you. I'm sorry. And then me using the word see while he's feeling, you can just see him kind of go. And then he goes, I feel your love. And I say, I see that I love you so much. I hate fighting with you. And he says, I feel so much better. And then you know what he does? He flips the polarity on me and he goes, I see somebody needs a spanking. And I go, I feel okay. You know, right? Like, and that's how quickly a fight can end because you're using the gift of polarity, but you're not using polarity as a weapon. So important, right? So important. The deeper you get into this work, you got to always remember the gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then other times we have more work to do and we will both feel, and we just don't put the weight of needing great sex in that moment on that moment. We're meeting that moment, and that moment is feeler with feeler, you know? And that's a beautiful exchange. And when you have when you're a masterful lover and you really know how to create polarity at any moment you want, you don't need to have polarity all the time, right? You're not afraid if there's not polarity. Justin and I love resonance, which we call it resonance when we're just palling around, when we're best friends, when we're soulmates, when we're feeling with each other, you know, like we love that part of our relationship. We feel so gifted that we love to snuggle. And then we also feel gifted that we know how to fuck. You know what I mean? When snuggling gets a little too watery and there's like nobody in charge and it all feels kind of gross, like one too many rich meals at a restaurant, that's when we bring the structure back that creates the Tesla coils again, which is difference. So we indulge in same, same, and then we indulge in difference and keep kind of a healthy flow going based on the art, based on the moment, you know, based on what serves both. And Ava.
Of course.
Can't always be in deep fuck when you have a 4-year-old around. You know, you gotta like play the resonance card sometimes for her sake, right? You know, yeah.
Tiny humans need looking after.
Yeah. Or houses tend to burn down. Yes. Yeah.
They need some sort of supervision. Can't always be in the bedroom, unfortunately, as much as I'm sure a lot of us would love to. I really love all that you reflected on in that. And what I was really hearing as well is that it takes the oracle within us to sometimes go first as well. And this is something that I've also realized within myself, is that sometimes you do have to go first. And there can often be this, I guess, I've seen like an unhealthy kind of perspective on polarity teachings, where we're relying on the other person to always be in, you know, the leading pole, the alpha, or to always go first. And if they don't, then, you know, we're not meant to, and we're just meant to stay in that pole. But really, I think it's an act of devotion to sometimes switch that. And if we can feel it inside our bodies and we can have that awareness first, then to go first and open up to love will often create more love in the moment. And there's a real beauty in that. And, you know, sometimes I've been in the past, like, I like received something, or I've gotten off a call with a lover and like something's been triggered within me. And I'm like wanting to, they've sent a text afterwards and I'm like, I'm not going to respond to that. No. I'm closing. That's it. I'm out. And then I've had that little trigger come up and I've been like, but is that really devotion? I've kind of gotten a little bit annoyed at myself. I'm like, okay, now I'm judging myself. Let's come back to love. And then I've just taken the moment to be like, okay, send the text message, do it with love, and share what you're really like moving through from your heart, rather than closing off and ignoring, which is like what I would usually have done in the past, to just close, be silent. And I think that's very common for us to be silent, right? We've been taught that that's how we punish and how we withhold love. So that brings me to the point of weaponizing polarity teachings, because I think that's something that we commonly do. So how do we avoid weaponizing? How do we open to love and stay open in that? Is it cultivating that awareness within ourselves? Is it, you know, just going into the practice with a partner, doing what we've said in this podcast as a devotional practice? What are your thoughts on that?
It's pretty simple, actually, but it's wildly difficult to live. But the idea being, if you've got should, you know, you should be more masculine, you should be more feminine, you've weaponized polarity. If you could use the word should, whether you want to admit it or not, in your thought process and the words you said and the, you know, teaching behind whether or not to send a text, that's probably a good indication that you weaponize polarity. And the reason why that's kind of a disservice to the beauty of the teachings of polarity is because you lose the art. You're only playing half the piano. That would be like telling Stevie Wonder, you know, you should only play this side because you have a penis. You know, it's like, yeah, like where's the art? You lose the art, because when you have the whole piano, you have every note. And that's what I think, that's what makes Justin and I so unique. It's like, we never really saw it that way. Well, it was, but he and I we're consummate artists. Like our whole approach to life is art. And so we're always interested in full self-expression, full art. Like no moment is the same as the next moment. And so you need to be able to love all the way. Like, you can't have this idea, like in the middle of lovemaking, if you want to breathe him for a second, that you can't do that, you know, because there's something so hot about the tussle. Like Justin and I are very into like, he'll be breathing me. And then he'll pause his breath and I'll breathe into his balls and he'll feel like a surge of pleasure. And then he takes it back. I mean, it's like surfers cutting into waves. You can make love for 8 hours. If you're on a one note, it's like, you know, just the surfer just drops down a 10-foot wave in a straight line and then crashes at the bottom. So polarity weaponizing can get very complex. I could go into like super great detail about how we see it all the time. But I think the take home message, like the easy takeaway, is watch for the shoulds. And it's, I mean, in some ways, it's like, are you any less of a seer than a feeler? So why would you make love as less than a seer and a feeler? You know, in other words, be the oracle and the priest, right? Like we had an oracle and we had a priest who would interpret. And the priest. Yeah. And then he is too. And all you're doing is like dancing perfectly together like a tango. So hot. So hot. What's not hot is getting stuck. So what's not hot is like you become the seer and then he just wants you to be the seer for the rest of the relationship. That's not hot. And we're not saying that's hot. And that's not actually the teaching, because if that's the case, it's the ego hijacking spiritual concepts. There's no devotion. There's no feeling into the other person. There's just like caretaking, you know, codependency, using each other. Like none of that is true art, right? True art is like you're in the moment and you have no preference and you'll go in any direction for the sake of the deepest union imaginable. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's really common, the weaponizing, because again, we're just kind of in the shadow body a lot of the time. We're trying to learn these, I think, these ways of relating from the shadow body, and we're not actually fully alchemizing them so that they come through in their purified, you know, form, which is quite funny. And it's a paradox. So we're like over here, like, yeah, we're practicing sacred intimacy, but in reality, we're just like vomiting all of our stuff onto the other person. And it's a bit of a mind fuck. So I think just as with any practice, right, I feel relational intimacy can be quite psychedelic. I think sex can be quite psychedelic. And it's like a trip, like Mother Aya taking you on a journey, basically destroying your ego and bringing you back to love again and again and again. I've experienced that so many times where I've been in a moment and with a lover, and I think I know. And then later on, I'm like, I fucking don't know. Like, I actually have no idea. And then I come back and I'm like, okay, I know a little bit more than I did before after digesting and then alchemizing and integrating those learnings. So from my perspective, I feel like relational intimacy, this work that you teach, can be such a psychedelic journey, an acid trip, a ceremony in itself. And it's really beautiful to, yeah, witness this and have these teachings shared in the way that you do, in a way that is accessible for people, and I think really liberates love out of the dogma, out of the weaponizing, and really brings it back to the core teaching, which, you know, these teachings were meant for, in my opinion. So I really, really appreciate the work that you're doing. And within that, let's say there is a woman that is listening to this podcast, or, you know, people are interested in diving into this work. And I tend to see more females being oriented towards this work of intimacy. I feel like maybe it's because we are, you know, we're more oriented towards love. We come from the heart. Not that males aren't, or other beings on the planet aren't. We just tend to have this draw, I've seen in my work, especially like you see it in childhood, right? Girls are playing with their Barbies and they're kissing like the male, and, you know, they're talking about like riding a pram down the pathway with their little baby in it. They're like, I'm with my imaginary husband. It's very much rooted in us. And that could be from Disney. It could be from romance movies, wherever it comes from. I feel like we're very oriented through the heart and love. So if a woman is, you know, wanting to drop deeper into this work, she wants to invite her man or her beloved into the path of sacred intimacy, what would you share with her? Have you done this yourself? I feel like I may have had this, but correct me if I'm wrong. And yeah, I'd love to hear your reflections on that.
First of all, I just want to acknowledge before I answer that it is so painful to learn about this stuff and feel like your partner isn't practicing, you know, like to want to be on this journey with somebody, to be in a relationship already, and to just feel like, you know, it's not happening like you wish you would. So it's a deep pain. And I acknowledge that as I give this answer, but it's important that I'm honest, because one of my commitments is that I only teach what I do. I will only teach what I do, because that's where all the dogma comes from, is like teaching ideals, you know? So I'm always only going to answer with what I've done, because I know I did it and I was able to do it. Like it's achievable. What I did, because, you know, I was deep in this work when I met Justin. So I was the one that kind of brought him into the work, but not in the way that you would think, in that I never mentioned the work. I just lived the teachings. Mm. And I waited for him to ask me about it. You know, to say, like, I don't know what I thought he would say, but I just never, ever, ever, ever asked him to like do anything. And the way I did that was I did my side of the street and I let go completely of whatever he chose to do with it. I wasn't trying to win love with it, and I wasn't trying to not lose love, and I wasn't trying to change him. I truly accepted him for who he was, if he would never change. Now, I also set boundaries. As you know, my first book, The Awakened Woman's Guide to Everlasting Love, I talk about, at one point I broke up with him because he wasn't willing to be monogamous. And I said to him, listen, I get it. Like, you know, he was young at the time and he was not interested in relationship, and I didn't want to convert him. And so I said, you go do you, but I'm wildly dedicated to surrendering at the highest level. And I can't if I don't trust you. And you always have other women dripping off of you when we get together. And like, it's just causing me to defend myself. Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking for something where I can just like go mindless, you know? So you do you, I'm going to do me. And we separated for a while. And then he ended up coming back and saying, I'm doing you, which was really lucky for me. But I never told him about the quote unquote work. Like, I talked about ideas like, I want to surrender, you know, I want to be a whole body yes to your very essence. Like, I want to make love where we both see the face of God. I was saying stuff like this because that's what was in my heart, but I wasn't saying like, so you need to read this book by this person. I never did that. And then eventually he was curious, and I could go into more details about what happened for him. It was a certain moment actually. And he was curious. And he started asking me about like why I had all these abilities that other women, so especially after we broke up, you know, and he just dated everyone, kind of played the field, and nobody was doing any of what I was doing. They weren't being vulnerable. They weren't surrendering. They weren't being honest with their emotions, you know, even if it made them look pathetic, and they weren't receiving him. They were like game facing him, you know, bulletproof chick, you know, and he dated like super hot chicks, but he felt them very closed compared to me. And I was 14 years older than him. I mean, I was way older than him because he was 24 or 25 at the time. And like me being at my age, like I was way older at that age. Now I don't feel like I'm that much older because he's older, but back then I was really old. And he just couldn't shake the fact that something really sacred was happening every time we got together that wasn't happening. And then he ended up becoming curious. And then I brought him to a workshop and that changed everything for him. But it was his choice. He wanted to come because of what he had been experiencing for a very long time. We were together, you know, I mean, we were off and on and all that stuff, but we had been interacting with each other for quite a while. And so it was consistent. It wasn't like a one night thing. And he was like, what are you doing? It was like, he just saw my behavior. You know, he would lose my trust in the way I would show him. Or he would like breathe a deep breath and I would breathe it into my body. He would just be like, wow, you know, I was doing all of these things. I think he was just constantly in a state of like, wow. And that's what I recommend any woman listening is like, just become the world's greatest practitioner. He's going to notice and he's going to want to know why. Mm-hmm. And then when it's his idea, he'll actually do it. But if you bring it up, the chances of him voluntarily walking in are really small. You know, we used to do, Justin and I do couples mentorships where we together work with another couple. And a couple, you know, years ago, we would allow the woman to sign a couple up. But time and time again, the man in the dynamic just never really got on board because he felt so dragged in. It wasn't his choice. And now he's asked to do all of this like deep, vulnerable, searching work. And, you know, and it just never goes well. And so Justin and I, at this point in our work, we have to interview the man. It has to be equally his desire, his passion as hers, because otherwise it's kind of like abuse. Like he's just being rehabbed. You know, he's like party to his own rehabilitation project. You know what I mean? And I just recommend you don't do that. If you feel like you need to rehabilitate him, find someone else.
Yeah. Yeah. That really hits deep. What I'm hearing as well is, you know, you went first, right? You went first and you embodied what you were learning, what you're finding out, connecting to the divine. You were embodying the essence of love. And that was the invitation for him. And I feel like it takes a whole lot of fucking devotion and a whole lot of trust and a whole lot of surrender to be in that space, to be the one who is devoted to that. And then to trust that, you know, it may or may not happen, and to trust that whatever is going to happen will happen. And I feel your story is really inspiring because it's a story in which you embodied that and it did come to fruition. And now you're in this beautiful space of divine love with that beloved because you chose to go first.
I did. I mean, there's one other key part of this story that no one ever picks up on, which is an important piece, which is he lost my trust. You know, like he never really, I mean, he didn't like say we were exclusive, but like, you know, it was rough when I found out some such deep, deep connection was going on with us. And then he could go see somebody else the next day. Right. Like I couldn't even, you know, you talked about the love driven being, like, I couldn't even conceive of that. Mm-hmm. And so it didn't even occur to me to ask if we were exclusive, you know? And then it did occur to me at one point to ask, and he was like, oh no, we're not. And I was like, wait, what? You know what I mean? Like, huh? And that felt like, you know, he didn't lie to me, but that felt like a huge loss of trust. Like you could connect to me that deeply and then go connect to someone else. Like, whoa. And that was when I set the boundary, walked away. And when he came back and he said, I've done my searching, I'm all in. I'm all in with you for life. I got to be honest with you. There was a part of me that didn't want to trust. And that was part of my practice, was to, again, not bring the Rolodex, but be in the right now moment. And what he was standing in the right now moment was a consciousness that I trusted. And I surrendered into that. And I thought, this is the greatest man I've ever met. There's a lot of hurt here. I mean, honestly, to be real with you, when we were apart, I couldn't even breathe. I could not breathe for the whole time we were apart. I was a mess. You know what I mean? Because I felt so connected to him and I was holding my ground, but I was suffering. And then when he came back, I was so surprised. And I chose to trust him. And I didn't trust him because his history had hurt me. But who he was in the right now moment, I trusted. And then the next day, and then the next day, you know? And like, I think if I hadn't had the practice that I have, I wouldn't have given him another chance. I would have protected myself and not wanted to feel that hurt twice, right? But my heart and my yoni trusted him in that moment. And my brain was freaking out. And I didn't listen to my brain. And you know what? He has not let me down. Mm. And as you said earlier in this podcast, like, it's more than a decade. I don't even know how long it's been now, but it's definitely more than a decade. We've been saying 12 years for a long time. Could be way more. But the point is, he followed through. And I'm so glad I trusted him. Huh?
I feel like that then also would have built your trust, even though you kind of had that initial feeling inside your, well, thought inside your mind, and then you had the trust of your own body. What I'm hearing is that you trusted your own body, and then his trust also built onto that.
Yeah. And also what allowed me to trust him wasn't time. A lot of women get this wrong. I'm constantly saying this to my private clients, is like, you can't expect time. You can expect how you feel in the moment. Mm-hmm. But what allows trust to build in the moment is when you're in your full expression. Because remember, part of my right now moment was being so hurt by what had happened between us. And so I would show it. It would come, like maybe we would make love and I would open to a certain point, and then I would just feel how scary it is to trust again, how ouchy it was, you know, like that's happening in the right now moment. And I would show him all of it, and he would just be like, I'm here. Show me more. I'm here. This is what, how I learned to do it for Ava. Show me more. I'm here. Show me more. I'm here. That's what built my trust. I would be quote unquote inconvenient. You know, my fullness would be like pouring out everywhere. And I could really, truly feel he was here for it. He had like signed up for it. You know, he went on his vision quest and he came back ready for me. Mm. And I trusted that. Does that make sense? And that's why I just recommend to every woman I can ever meet is like, show him your fullness. Because if he receives it beautifully, you will trust that man.
Mm. Yeah, beautiful. In the instances when a woman is revealing her fullness, and we touched on this a little bit before, but let's say it's not being received well, does she just keep practicing? Does she just keep opening? Does she just keep trusting? What are your thoughts on that? Because it can, I think oftentimes we come to those moments, actually now I'm being reflected with something that you said before, is that you don't come with the past, but you just come with the present moment and you trust that.
But you're asking a good question, because I just said that a lot of that hurt was in my present moment from the past, mm-hmm. but that's different than my mind.
Right.
The hurt is in the present moment. It's like energy that needs to move, right? Versus the narrative from my mind, like, I shouldn't trust him because he hurt me one time, right? That's like a past narrative versus a present feeling. It's very normal to feel a feeling. Like, there's an energy, but there's a truth in the field between you. Yeah. And that's going to be there, right? And he was all in for that. And that's why I trusted him. But had he not been all in that, I wouldn't have trusted him. Like, trust isn't something I generate. It's either there or not. And I would have known that he wasn't all in. Now, there is one thing that as a practitioner, you can do to check yourself if your fullness isn't being received, because sometimes we think we're doing this, but we're not, which is if you have felt something, contracted your heart, and now you're expressing through a contracted heart, it's going to come out like venom. Yeah. It's going to come out like victim. Venom. It's, you know, like, wah, you know, again, another, you know, with polarity weaponizing, ask if there's a should. With contracted heart, if you could say the words always or never, you're probably in a contracted heart. You know what I mean? And so, right, if you've contracted your heart and you're innervating your expression through a contracted heart, it's not going to awaken him. He's not going to receive it well, right? Because your contraction innervates his contraction. So that's the one thing I say is Justin doesn't always receive my fullness well, but usually if I trace my awareness, I'm like, oh, I'm actually like literally projecting contraction onto him. And then when I find my true vulnerability, like I soften my heart, even when it's, I feel pathetic or it feels really hard or so freaking vulnerable. If I soften my heart and I keep expressing, it's like you just see him melt too. And now it's bringing us together instead of dividing us. So the only thing I would say is just, you know, it's important to check yourself because you may think you're more open than you are, you know, and the field kind of shows you. Now that said, sometimes you soften your heart all the way and that person just isn't signing up for a relationship. They don't want to be in the relational field. Now you look with naked eyes and you don't try and get water out of a rock. There's, you know, some men are ready to dance with the feminine and some men are just not on board with that right at this moment in their life. And I was very careful not to date men who don't feel like dancing with the feminine because you just have to put yourself in such a tight little box that you lose all your self-esteem and then it just destroys everything else in your life. You know, your sexuality is your life force. And like, you should be blooming. Life is too short. Squash it, you know? That's essentially what I said to Justin. Like, I'm not squashing this shit. So I just need someone I can trust.
Yeah.
You know, more power to you. You're awesome. I wish I could be with you, but I can't. And I don't want to diss people who are into poly because some people have a very karmic relationship to letting go of possession, you know, and doing that sadhana. That's just not the sadhana I chose for myself. I wanted the sadhana of depth versus width. Like I'm in the blender with somebody and we got to figure it out because we're not going to be able to go outside of this thing. What are we going to do next? And Justin was really into that once he chose it. And now we kind of love that because if it gets dull, you know, we got to figure it out. And that's where the book Playing with Fire came from.
Yeah. Yeah. I can definitely relate to what you're saying because I'm primarily monogamous. I'm not for poly myself. I have nothing against it. If that's people's path, that's your path. Beautiful. For me, I tried it for maybe a week to 2 weeks. And I do not think I will go back. I don't know future me because you can't predict the future, but I do not think it's something that I would invest myself in again. I just couldn't do it. I felt myself yearning for so much more commitment and closeness and then feeling that kind of like separate as we went different ways or we were related with other people. And then you would come back to this point where you're in the connection again and then it would, you know, move into a different space. And it was just too much for my body and my heart. And I was like, okay, I've tried this. I don't think that poly is for me. And the jealousy is all quite an interesting one. Like it would change from person to person as well. Like no dynamic is ever the same. And in certain dynamics, there'd be like a little bit more of jealousy, a little bit more of like, ah, am I going to lose love here? Or, ah, are they going to leave me for this person over here? And it was just quite interesting to constantly being shown my shadows again and again. And I also believe we can have that in monogamous relationships. And it can be even stronger and more stable in those containers from my perspective as well. It's been a beautiful teacher.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it's been so profound to not have an out, you know, it's kind of like forced us to keep our fire alive with each other. Cause both of us are so sexual, but after you've made love to the same person thousands of times, like how do you generate that mystery and intrigue, you know? And that's why our teachings have evolved to where they have, because Playing with Fire, the new book, is literally about not letting your pilot light go out. inside of this commitment of not getting newness from the outside, mm-hmm. you know? And it's been so amazing how exciting it gets when you, like, when you understand how to do it and that it's based in physics, not strange. You have all of that trust from being in that tight container, plus all of that sizzle. And oh my God, I mean, we call it like weaving a rug together. It's like those threads just get tighter and tighter and tighter. And every time you see the face of God together, tighter. Right. And so I don't know. It's been, I'm really glad that I chose that path for myself. And it's been a great sadhana.
Yeah, I found it to be a really rich, rich path, a rich path in awakening.
Yes.
Really, truly wakes you the fuck up to everything that is conscious around you. It wakes you the fuck up to even how you move in your business and in your community and your sisterhoods. It is such a deep reflection, the path of relating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I really also believe that, because a lot of this podcast is around, and a lot of what I do is around helping women, you know, experience deeper pleasure in their body, have deeper intimate connections sexually, and really building that erotic life force within us. I believe that a lot of it is like, yes, it's all, it's like sexual, but a lot of it isn't pertaining to just what happens inside the bedroom. A lot of it's actually the outer realm of what happens in relationship and our communications and things like these teachings and how we are resonating each other in every moment, how we're responding to one another's. I feel like a lot of the pieces to creating like deep sexual, hot, erotic intimacy isn't just in the bedroom. I feel like a lot of it's also what happens in the relational sphere and how we are resonating each other, how we're responding to one another, how we're opening to one another or closing, how we're speaking, you know, that awareness and that lack of awareness. So all of this is really valuable into getting into that point of having hotter sex, having deeper erotic intimacy in the bedroom. Have you experienced that for yourself? And do you kind of resonate with that at all? Or do you have a different perspective on that, that you can offer?
Oh, I just think you're so right. So true. Everything you said is 100%. And if anything, I don't think it can be emphasized enough, because so many people don't realize that the bedroom carries the weight of everything that happened in the house.
Let that land. Yeah.
And I hate to say it, but I particularly see this in the male partners. They sort of go, you know, like, for example, here's a great example of this is like somebody who doesn't know anything yet, who shuts a woman's expression down. Like maybe she's sad over something and she's shedding a tear and he says, don't cry. It'll be better. You know, you and your sister, you guys always make up. Don't worry about it. Just you're fine, honey. And then later that night they're making love and she can't come to orgasm. Right. Half of what we do is connect these dots for men. Like you're squelching her flow and then you expect it to just magically return in the bed. Right. You know, and like, what if you didn't shut her tears down? You said, oh, honey, you know, I see that this is really hard for you. I love your tears. I love your heart. What is she going to be like in the bedroom later that night?
I feel like I just got wet from that.
Totally, you know, right?
Like it opens.
She's going to be fully released because there's room for her. Oh, it's so important.
Yeah.
It's so important. And the other thing I want to say for the record is the thing that kills me about women that I talk to is they all blame themselves for being so dry. You know, they wonder what's wrong with them. They think there's something wrong with them, and they don't realize how turned off they are all day long. And then they expect themselves to be wet, you know, like, and so there's this element of when you understand like what really creates terrible lovemaking, like terrible lover, when you understand those comments in the day dry you up. You don't blame yourself for being dry at night. You're like, oh yeah, I don't feel like there's room for me in this relationship. And so my pussy just crawled right into a hole. You know, like she was like, yo, I'm not playing this game. This game sucks. So no do way. Whatever you want, nod, be the bobblehead, but I'm not here. You know what I mean?
And open and like, it.
Not happening. Yeah, like you might put up with all this, but I'm not. You know what I mean? And so I just love also letting women learn, like, you know, they have the right to be aroused. You know, they have the right to be turned on and to feel safe to unfold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then things magically correct themselves when that happens, right? You know, suddenly the bedroom's so interesting again with the same person.
Yeah, it's the most potent reflection, what happens in our intimate relationships and how that correlates to, you know, how hot or how numb the sex is, or how open, how wet it is, or how, you know, dry and stagnant that sexual flow becomes between you and a partner or a lover.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so I have a few, possibly a few questions that I've asked the Instagram world. Let's see if you're open to answering them, of course, maybe just a couple. Yeah. Okay, so what would be your recommendation, your reflection around balancing a partner with a high sex drive and being with one who doesn't need it as frequently? So essentially, you know, being with someone, dynamic where someone has a higher sex drive and one who doesn't need it as frequently. Put quotation marks in need as well. And I feel like we all need sex frequently and it is a necessity to be well fucked. But say maybe desire it as frequently.
And what's the question again?
So
how do you balance it? Or
yeah, balancing a dynamic where there's one partner with a high sex drive and there's another partner who doesn't desire it as frequently. How would one balance that dynamic, or maybe, yeah, invite more heat into that dynamic?
I just have to side note that this is what our whole book is about, right? The new book is like, so I'm trying to like, I'm looking at our book and I'm thinking like, how do I sum up 350 pages in one sentence?
Yeah, I'll add that to the show here. As well, the book title.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Okay. The biggest thing is if you want to stimulate someone into more sexuality and you are, you know, you're roaring to go and they're not, what most people do with that is they come on so strong. They need, you know, they sort of like try and change their partner. Or they flip and they squash their own desire and like turn it all, like they douse their own fire or they breathe fire onto the other. What the book teaches you how to do is to circulate your fire. So you're in your fully loaded desire and simultaneously complete equanimity, allowing what is here. And by this, you become so wildly seductive. You create so much polarity from the point of view of polarity balanced with equanimity that you heat the moment up and you become a massive invitation into. And we see it work constantly. This is what we're teaching most of the time, because that imbalance you're talking about, and I know you asked the question because you're the same, it's everywhere all the time. That's intimate relationship. It's almost always going to be a mixture of somebody who's raring to go and somebody who doesn't want to go at all. It's constantly, it ends up there, not in the beginning, but later. And we call it playing with fire. You learn how to play with fire.
Yeah.
I hope I was able to sum up an entire book in a couple of sentences.
In a couple of sentences, we shall try. Really, the book is the ultimate transmission, but limited amount of time. We can't unfortunately do a whole book reading here. And the transmission is gone in one hour call. And another question was, how do you invite a wild fantasy into your like now reality? I summarized it because some of the questions aren't specifically written in a way that is a question, if that makes sense. But how do we own more of our wildest fantasies? And I would say that summarizes it. Let's say you've got like a wild fantasy that you're wanting to embody. How do you bring that to the dynamic? How do you bring that to the moment in the bedroom or the relationship, essentially?
So having a wild fantasy is wonderful because most people don't even know what they want anymore. So that means you know what you want, which is wonderful. I'm sure you're coaching your clients all the time and like rediscovering what they want, which is great. What most people do is they're so twisted up around what they want that they inelegantly bring it to their partner, right? They either like are expecting rejection, or they're so awkward that they kind of like have all their defenses up when they suggest the idea, like, I would really love it if you would tie me up, you know, right? Like they come, that was exaggerating, but like their energy is like shame and embarrassment and eking it out, you know? And what I would say is you begin living as the living embodiment of your wild fantasy. I do this every morning in practice with Justin, where I'm in like, what would make this moment make time disappear for me? And then I start being it, right? I'm not waiting for permission. I just begin being it. And then by my super empowered, 100% all in, no shame, no hiding, no needing approval, I just become so endlessly interesting in it. He just dives right into it. And same with him. But we also have the thing where if the other partner's not ready, we don't shut down. So like I might insert an idea and he might not be ready. So he's like, whoa. I don't then go into shame. I'm like, okay. And then he says something and I'm still all the way here. Like I'm not going to cave. And I'm not going to fall apart, because you have to imagine that's a lot of fire. And that might be a little like hot for somebody and they need to get used to those flames for a second. And Justin does the same thing. Like, for example, sometimes I'll put on some crazy outfit and I'll sit down for practice and first thing he says, I want your mouth around my cock. But even though I have some crazy outfit on, like, I'm not there yet. You know, like that's not what I want. I want to like start with like some cool breathing and like, you know. And so instead of being like, you know, like, no, like I, as if I'm obliged to do what he said, I'll be like, not yet. And then I'll go, what I want is for you to breathe me in a way where I can't help but slide my tongue all over your cock. And he'll be like, okay. Right. So can you see the dance that occurs where we're not shaming each other, where we're like, but we're also not obliging, because if you oblige, you're sort of like halfway there, but we're sort of like dancing with it and like meeting each other. Like he plays a note. I play a note. He goes, he plays a note. I play a note. This is what our sexing looks like every morning. And it's fucking bananas, because we're fully revealed in what we want. We're fully comfortable with our wants, and we're in total equanimity with them. Like I could say what I want and not get it. Because again, I can circulate the energy. I don't need it to be met for it to be okay. Kind of the same thing we've been talking about the whole podcast, right? It's like, I'm fully in it and I don't need it to be met for it to be okay. So I have space. I have space for you to get there. I have space for you to be a no.
Yeah.
I think some people, when they get into those dicier territories, they just, if the other person's like not a yes, it's going to go, you know, it's like, there's like this obligatory yes that has to happen because you're in sensitive territory, you know, it's such a buzzkill for sex. Like we're all caretaking each other because our wants are so scary. You know, Justin and I aren't scared of our wants. We're completely masterful around them. And when you, that's what it means to be a masterful lover, right? You have full equanimity and full desire. Does that make sense? Isn't that cool? It's a total paradox. It's like I want and I allow at the same time.
You can have it all.
Yeah, it's so good. And there's like an honoring of the other person because you're not like running your trip on them.
Yeah, potent. I really love in a piece of that how you were speaking about, I kind of read it as like an energetic consent, because I had a thought and I was like, well, you know, desires, fantasies, right, to bring that onto someone would need some level of consent with them. And I think there's also a dance in the moment, like where you can be attuned enough and aware enough of their body, which again is the practice from my perspective, to feel them enough so that when there isn't consent, you can feel that, right? And yes, when they're really with you, then you can still continue with that fantasy and like really embodying it, bringing it to the space. So that's also something that I would add to that.
I love what you just said.
Everything you said.
Yes.
Spot on as well.
Yeah. No, what you just said is so important, and it's what makes it all work. You know, because sometimes there's consent until there's not. Right? Like it can go a little too far or something, or like the person stops breathing, they lose being present. Like they get so into their desire that they're no longer even present with you. And then even though you were yes, like 2 minutes ago, now you're like, whoa, this is like, now I just feel like you're using my body, you know, or like, can we come back into where this is like uniting us, you know? So it's that sensitivity, it's that constant awareness that really allows it to keep surging between the two, right? Yeah, so good. So good. So glad you said that.
Delicious. Where can people find more of your work? Where can we find more of your offerings? Do you have anything at the moment that you're offering that people can find this work on? And I'll also, yes, I'll link the book, like I said, so I'll leave that in the show notes.
Yep. So Playing with Fire is on Amazon. If you do Playing with Fire Pierce, you can sift through all the romance novels called Playing with Fire. But then my website is London, LONDIN, angelwinters.com. And the offerings are always there. We do Patreon, where we have a monthly women's circle and a monthly couples practice. And that's all on my website, as well as links to my first book, Awaken Woman's Guide to Everlasting Love, which is also a really great place to start.
Yeah,
those are the best places to find me. We have, I think almost every one of our in-person workshops are sold out. So I can't really promote those because we're completely booked for the rest of the year. But we do offer in-person intensives, and there'll be enrollments opening for next year pretty soon.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I'll add all of that into the show notes as well as your website, so people can jump on there if they want to find this work, because it is so rich, it is so juicy, and it is so fucking needed, I think, on our planet. This has been a really delicious conversation.
I've had so much fun.
Thank you for conversing with me and co-creating and transmitting whatever this podcast turns out to be.
total joy. It was just so fun to talk to you, and I can just see how deeply you practice through your questions. So it was really fun for me.
Thank you.
And that, my loves, brings us to the end of this episode. I hope you loved it, and it definitely brought me some new insights. What I really love about these conversations around all the nuances of polarity teachings, union, relationship, is that it really awakens us so that we can enter into deeper states of mastery within really cultivating relational skills, which allow us to have hotter sex, deeper intimacy, deeper love, being blossomed in the way that we relate to others and the world and with a partner. This is so necessary to thrive in life, because as so many studies have told us, you know, the way we relate and our relationships affect our happiness and our joy and our way of being. And from my own perspective, how turned on we are in life. This is why I do what I do. This is why I share the conversations that I do, because it is a really big piece of living a turned on, ecstatic, thriving fucking life for all of us. So if you've been loving this podcast or you love this episode, feel free to leave a review on the iTunes page or on Spotify. This allows me to reach way more women and men or human beings all over the world and really get the podcast out so that we can really liberate together as a collective.